I'm Prentice Hemphill, and this is Finding Our Way. So this period of time has taught me a lot about who my people are, who my community is. It's been the friends that I check in on, the friends that check in on me. It's been my neighbors who bring food to me or I take food to them. It hasn't always been what I thought it would be. Maybe community is like a body. A community feels and responds. It lives, it grows, it changes. Community to me is a way that people come together to sync up their nervous system and their cares, to share responsibility and their abundance. We build these networks of interrelation that extend beyond and include those who we call family, coordinates of kin. Many of us are born into communities and, like families, as we get older, we begin the work of building our own or reshaping the ones in which we reside. Many of us have experienced, too, the trauma of community expulsion. We might carry the fear of belonging, but we might also carry the desire to be known just as we are. Our next guest, Mia Birdsong, is the author of How We Show Up, a new book about how we make family and community. Mia has been committed to the expansion of our concepts and practice of relationship, whether it's through her work around guaranteed universal basic income with the Economic Security Project, or as the co-founder of the think tank Family Story. Mia is always helping us reimagine care and connection. What Mia Birdsong offers in this conversation and in her book are the really feelable possibilities of a community that actually allows us to grow, communities that aren't only organized around our shared pain, but are also organized around our shared possibilities and purpose. And as inconvenient and vulnerable as it might feel to belong with each other, as unpracticed as we might be in it, we might just need each other. What Mia awakened in me, and I hope also can awaken in you, is a real desire to build and be in the kind of community that continues to make us as we make it. We really hope you enjoy the conversation.
I'm really glad to be doing this right now.
I feel so honored about that. Huh. Mia, I feel genuinely excited to be in this conversation with you. I, in the last few months, have had kind of organic interactions with you where our paths have crossed in community, and it has always felt delightful, just a little kind of touch-ins that we've had. And I want to say to you that when I was trying to put this podcast together and I was getting in my own way, I reached out to some friends for support and a mutual friend connected us. And you didn't know me. We had never spoken. And the kind of support and thoughtfulness and encouragement you just readily offered was profound to me, and I think is really a part of why I was able to get over the hump and actually create this podcast. So I want to thank you, and I want to say how excited I am to be in conversation with you.
That just brings me so much joy, and I am ecstatic to be here with you.
Oh, I'm going to take that in. When I read your book, it activated this longing in me that in some ways I felt kind of irritated by. It's like, I want that community that Mia's talking about. I want to feel, is that possible? Just really woke something up in me. So that's why I really wanted to have this conversation with you and to have you come here and really talk about what it takes to build community, to sustain community in this moment. And I think your book just has so many rich offerings for us. So I'm excited to kind of dig into that with you. I don't know if I have the timing right, but you wrote this book, you released this book, and then COVID-19 hit. Then there were uprisings. Is that right?
Well, the book didn't come out until June.
Okay.
But I certainly had like finished it and was, you know, doing all the stuff that one does kind of leading up to the release of a book to get ready for it.
I feel like this moment that the book came out, and I'm curious your experience, but these conversations, these questions about care, about collective care, about accountability, they just all rose to the surface at the same time through the kind of breakdowns around our healthcare system, around the pervasiveness of this illness and the lack of protection we were experiencing, around the uprisings and the way the institutions were not protecting us. So these questions just really rose to the top. So if you could say more about the just kind of timing of this project and what you see in that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, on the one hand, thinking about what it means to build and be in close family or community with other people when we can't physically be together is hard and painful. On the other hand, I think the kind of, I've been calling it the like matryoshka of crises, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. Has also just laid bare how deeply interdependent we are, whether we like to admit it or not, and how much we need each other, especially when our systems and institutions are failing miserably by design to give us the things that we all need and deserve.
And it feels like in your project, you're saying that community plays a critical role in restoring that. I mean, the title of your book, How We Show Up, Reclaiming Family, Friendship, and Community, it's about generating a kind of resource through and in each other that we're not getting elsewhere.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we're in the United States. We live in a place where the dominant culture really is in many ways anti-community and anti-family, by which I mean like there is a very specific narrow idea of what kind of family is okay, this like insular, heteronormative nuclear family. But what family really is not about a structure, but about a network of relationships, whether those are biological or legal or otherwise chosen. Part of what I think I keep feeling about the uprisings is that there is a rebellion happening, not just against kind of, you know, systemic white supremacy, but against these entrenched, fucked up, like ideals of what America is and supposed to be. And I think in that, I see us like reaching toward what is ultimately really inherent to who we are as people. And we are, you know, we're pack animals. Like, mm-hmm. We need each other. We want each other. And I see how the chaos and crisis and the uncertainty, you know, has us kind of like grasping tightly for each other and really reaching for the lifeline that is our relationships with each other.
It's so true. And I think if I'm just really honest with you, I am the kind of person that is, I think because of trauma, because of my experience, I'm prone towards being a recluse. So when I talk about your book, Activating My Longing, it was that for me. I can feel the ways that I've personally been so shaped by this context into self-reliance, but also that secondary shaping that I got through my own community of what happens at home or what happens in our community stays here, that there's actually a fear of being seen, exposed, yeah, known in a kind of way.
Yep.
And I'm so deeply shaped by that because of all the secrets that had to be kept, of because there were stories that couldn't be told. And so when I read your book, I was like, it's such a clear offering and almost could take me step by step into really building out a dynamic, mutually supportive community. And it honestly rattled me because I could see the places where I was just so deeply shaped by the American context and also by some of our trauma responses that our communities can have.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
You know, I think, yes, totally. I mean, I think that that's same. Like,
yeah,
I think that, as you know, there's kind of the cultural socialization that I experienced. And I think as a Black girl, I was raised by a single mother. I'm an only child. So there was a certain kind of independence and self-reliance that I developed and was like rewarded as a child. And then I went to predominantly white schools where I both, you know, kind of explicitly and implicitly got the message that, you know, I just had to be a badass. Like, I had to just excel at everything. It was as if I was set up to like disprove a bunch of things about, you know, who Black people are. And man, I like took to that and I totally excelled. I mean, I did a great job at all of that. And, you know, and again, I got all of this, this praise because of that. You know, I was very much like a poster child. And so much of my identity was built around my tremendous independence, my ability to do things myself. You know, even some of the, you know, I remember at some point my mom telling me to like never let myself become dependent on a man, which was like, you know, I think a kind of like feminist like present, like that's how she was thinking of it. But man, I took that to heart. Like, you know, I'm in my, so I'm, you know, I'm married to a man and like, I'm the breadwinner. There are all these ways in which like, I just, all of those things kind of coalesced in a way that like, it's not that I was, you know, I feel like I created deep friendships and, had chosen family growing up and, you know, kind of into my own kind of, you know, leaving home and stepping into adulthood. But there was only so like so far that I would let people in. Certainly, I felt like I couldn't stop being excellent and be kind of like a whole messed up, still trying to figure it out person. You know, and for me, that's like so much of that is about my like deep aversion to vulnerability. So I think, you know, when this book, I mean, I can think, I can kind of trace back so many kind of different starting points for it. But ultimately it was really that I felt like the way that my life was set up, you know, like I said, I'm like married to a man, we have biological children, you know, I own my home. We are like solidly, as much as one can be solidly anything in our economy, like we're solidly middle class. And there's this kind of inertia that exists around the, you know, the more I kind of move toward the ideal that the American dream kind of has set up for all of us to want and reach for, the less connected I felt to people and community. And there had been this like kind of constant tension there for me, because in some ways I just wanted to like just let go and like let the current of all of the stuff that I feel like we get told about how to find success and happiness, I just wanted to let it like take me and be like, okay, I'm just gonna like go do this thing. Because that's what like that's what the promise is, and who am I to like counter that? And then I also knew, like, you know, both intellectually, but also like in my heart, that that was a lie. And like, ultimately just like deeply destructive to my spirit. You know, I do this thing when I feel like I'm faced with, like, I have to make a really hard decision or I have to face a risk, where I imagine myself at like, you know, 112, because I'm a live long time, like reflecting back on my life, you know, and I kind of imagine the, whatever the different decisions are I can make and how I will think about them, whether or not, like, regardless of outcome. And that 112 year old version of me always points me toward facing fear, points me toward more love, points me toward more, you know, more openness, more care. So I feel like in many ways, like I was kind of guided by her. And then probably also, I feel like there's a child version of me that also I can ask the same things.
Yes.
And I feel like they were like, no, you can't like harden yourself and follow the like well-carved path. Because you know it's bullshit. They were like, you know that's bullshit. But also that it's not what I want and ultimately mm-hmm. isn't gonna, you know, kind of allow me to do what I need to do and with this like, you know, one life that I have.
That's right.
So I think for me, a lot of the book, you know, I thought I was spending, you know, 2 years writing a book, but really it was like 2 years of my own kind of personal journey and trying to find all of the, like the stories that I needed to replace stories that, you know, were given in this country about what care and community and love and success and happiness look like. I was mm-hmm. like, I need new stories. Let me go find them. And oh my God. Like, there are just so many and they're out there for us.
We all needed those stories. I mean, when I was listening to your book and I was just like, gosh, is this, I needed this confirmation that this is a reality, that people have tried this, that people have learned inside of this model. It was just so important to feel that. And there's a couple different roads I want to go down just in all that you said. And one thing, just to kind of back us up a little bit, I was reflecting on what are the kind of emotional skills we need to develop. So when you talk about mm-hmm. being in conversation with your, you said 112?
Mm-hmm.
112-year-old self, yes. That she's like, here are some instructions. Don't do this, do more of this. And that is so, so helpful. I was thinking about shame a lot. Mm. And I think about shame a lot in my work with folks and my work as a teacher, as a practitioner. And I've been trying to understand, there's a shame that we kind of inherit through our family systems. And then there's this shame of internalized oppression, that's actually how internalized oppression shows up in our body, is the experience of shame about things that are fundamental to who we are. So shame about the color of my skin, shame about the size of my body, shame about how my body moves, shame about needing one another.
Yes.
And that it's just so, we're just so soaked in this society and all the things it tells us are not possible for us, all the places where we're not enough. And it's shame that we feel when we have these longings. So in thinking about your book, there's a piece where you're talking about a friend going to the grocery store and messaging you and saying, do you need anything? I'm at the store. And how that act broke down your experience of shame or your experience of, do you know what I'm saying? Not being able to say, oh, yes. I don't know what I need, or getting in the tangle of like, oh, I need something from another person. But the way they reached in, you were able to really answer that. So thinking about that and just like, what does it take for us? What are the things we have to reveal, break down, learn to do in order to be in real community with each other?
Yeah. So that story is not in the book because it's a story that, it's a thing that happened to me.
Where did I get that from?
Because I've talked about it all the time.
Oh, okay. All right.
Because it's one of the things that I feel like, you know, this is part of what's been great about this book is I'm like, you know, I did the book itself and then this unprecedented crisis happened for us. Just it washed away all of the like pretense that we don't need each other.
Right.
And in that, I feel like I had to like even more deeply confront some of my thoughts and feelings and assumptions about family and community and friendship. So what happened was, kind of toward the beginning of sheltering in place, a friend of mine texted me and like two or three other people. Like nobody prompted her to do this. She just did. She was going to the grocery store and she asked us if there was anything that she could pick up for us. And, you know, like the kind of like old stuff, like the training that's just like so embedded, right? Dismissed that idea like out of hand. Like I was like, I'm not going to have somebody go to the grocery store and get me anything. But I caught myself. I had developed enough like awareness of some of my training to see it. And I just like backtracked a little bit and just like unpacked why I was so dismissive of her offer. And I was like, oh yeah, that's that not wanting to be a burden, not wanting to appear needy, not wanting like hiding, like wanting to hide some. So much stuff comes out of this like simple thing where she was like, can I get you anything at the grocery store? And then I was like, okay, so let's throw out all that like old story stuff. And I was like, let me actually take in her offer and see what comes up. And what came up was I was like, I was almost out of salt and I can't cook without salt. And if she got me salt, I could not go to the grocery store for another week and a half. And this was right in the beginning too, when I feel like I was, you know, and I think a lot of us were being like, we were like 2 weeks, you have to go 2 weeks, you get 2 weeks of stuff and you don't go, for 2 weeks. And I was like, 2 weeks has not passed yet. And if she brings me salt, I can do three. And like, you know, and I was not going to go to the grocery store just to get salt. So I said, yes. And I said, salt. And she brought it by and like dropped it on my porch. She didn't ring the bell. She just left it. But my dogs barked and I heard her. So I went to the window and saw her and I waved to her and her face like lit up. And I was like, oh yes, she has done this helpful, like genuinely helpful, kind thing. But I was like, I cannot forget that when I allow someone to be generous, right? When I create room for their generosity to like exist, they get something out of it too.
Yes.
And like, of course, like I know that for myself. I know that when I'm able to like, you know, support and be generous to other people, like it makes me feel so good. And it's not about they owe me now or I've earned some points with my gods. It is just, it is about like being in relationship with people in this way that feels super restorative and allows us to know each other a little more. And I think with her and with a couple of other people, I feel like where, you know, either I've been stepping into generosity or they have with me, it's like we're, you know, weaving something together and like it adds threads to whatever it is we're weaving and makes it stronger. You know, and then like for in practical ways, I feel like if some shit went down, like for real, we definitely, I feel like the likelihood of the people who I'm doing that with for us to call on each other is way higher. Yes. And I would feel way more comfortable reaching out to folks if something, you know, awful happened and it was an emergency, I really needed something. So there's a very like practical piece to that, but like, you know, that's like our safety net. And partly what I've been thinking about is like, how do we not think of kind of that kind of generosity as only being about when shit goes down or when there's like emergency or when there's like real need, but how do we like create ease for each other? In that, like, if I think about that as some kind of web that I'm weaving with people in my life and that they're weaving with people in their lives, and that's kind of like these overlapping webs, I feel like there's like energy that gets put in that that is self-generating. So that when it's like when the alchemy of it is all working well, we're decreasing everyone's stress and anxiety and we're increasing everyone's ease. And I feel like I can almost, especially right now, because I feel like my intuition is just like heightened. I can feel when the energy is coming toward me and I can feel when it's leaving and I can feel how it increases, like as everyone's feeding it. And that to me is like, I'm like, that is what we all need. Like, that's the thing that we all want to be like plugged into with each other. And it's so powerful, I think, right now, because we're not physically with each other. And getting kind of some of our regular cues for what that would be like, to still feel like the energy along that, I'm using many metaphors here, I was going to say circuitry of the weave of the fabric, but whatever that is, all that stuff that's traveling around between all of us, like I can still like palatably feel it.
That question of how do we create more ease for each other? It just like rearranged something in me. Because it didn't feel, it doesn't feel taxing, or it's such a simple orientation to relationship.
Yeah.
A kind of like natural relationship to abundance, to each other, creating ease, and how that can flow through community. I'm like, that's just such a powerful question to be guided by.
Oh, yes. In this moment. Right? Because I think there are also those of us who overextend, right? Mm-hmm. Like we give when we don't actually have. That's like part of how we've been taught we are valuable when we're providing for other people or when we're doing for other people. And that's why I feel like the work that I've been doing and been taught around boundaries is so important. Yes. Right?
So important.
I feel like I didn't know what boundaries really were. And this is like, this is totally my therapist who I interviewed for the book, Shauna. So first of all, she said this thing to me about resentment. You know, I think that I was like, oh, when I'm feeling resentful, that's because somebody else is an asshole, right? Like somebody else like did some shit and I get to be like self-righteous and indignant about it. She's my therapist and she's my husband's therapist and she's also our therapist.
Okay.
Which is unusual, but she started out as our therapist and I was like, I feel like I have some stuff to do, but I don't really want to go find somebody else. Cause you know, I'm like, I don't know if like most therapists it's are so white. I have a black queer woman as a therapist. Yep. I'm like, can we do this? So, and we've been doing it for years and we're all good at maintaining whatever boundaries need to be maintained. Cause she does all this boundaries work. Anyway, so what she said to us about resentment is that resentment is information. If I'm feeling resentful, that's information for me.
That's right.
And I was like, what?
That's right.
She's like, somewhere along the way, you've given more than you should have.
That's right.
And I was just shit. Damn it.
It's so
I don't
true
get to be indignant and like I need to figure out like how am I setting boundaries.
That's the thing about when I teach about conflict and teach about boundaries, I talk a lot about resentment and I say it's such a delicious and acidic kind of feeling we allow ourselves. It's like, oh, I gave and gave and you didn't deserve, or you take it yes. for granted, but it has such a like, ugh. There's something so satisfying mm-hmm. about it in the worst way.
Because we get to be right.
We get to be so
and
right.
And we get to be we get to be the victim.
Yeah. I'm put out. It's just so good. That emotion. It's so good.
It is. And terrible.
And terrible.
So
and
she it, just like, yes, corrodes she just like, relationship. Ugh. She just like, she was like, that's information for you cause that you fucked up. And I was that's like, right. God damn it. But I think as we're talking about kind of generosity, right? So I think there's some folks for whom what they actually, the way that they need to set themselves in that like energy field mm-hmm. is by receiving and by saying mm-hmm. no. Mm-hmm. And that like that's their contribution, right? Mm-hmm. Their no is a contribution. The other thing I feel like I've learned is that no is to view my no's as information for whoever I'm saying no to, right? I'm letting mm-hmm. them I'm letting them know more about me.
Exactly.
Right?
Boundaries are a way to get to know each other and we totally. Often overlook that.
Well, and I think we're afraid to be known, right? And it's often like we often kind of bypass our boundaries because we don't want to because we want to stay in control in some way.
That's right.
I had a friend who I asked her to do something and she was like, oh, hell no. She was like, absolutely not. And this was like through, like it was either email or text. And I was like, that was a very clear boundary setting. And I remember sitting and like going through all of my feelings of rejection. Yeah. And I was like, okay, so that's my shit. I'm like, that's not hers. Like, this is my response to what she said. And I went through all of my whole thing of understanding that like she didn't do anything wrong and like my feelings of rejection were mine. And then I was like, oh yes, she's given me information about her. And I was like, and she's taking care of herself. So then, you know, I don't know how long, much later, like 10 minutes or something, I texted her back and I was like, thank you for taking care of yourself mm-hmm. and for modeling like such good boundaries. Wow. And I was a very proud moment because I was like, oh, I'm having all of the stuff. Like, let me be self-aware and not just like either sulk and not say anything or like throw that back at her. I was like, let me get to what's under all of this. And I was like, yes, that's whatever. My stuff is about rejection. And she's giving me she's showing me herself. And I'm going to receive that like as a good friend should by thanking her and respecting that.
That's right. And that you're so right. That's so much of how and why we avoid building community, because we have to feel all those things when we come mm-hmm. up against one another. It's like, oh, I feel rejected by you, and you get to be sovereign over your life and body and time. And I have to feel all that. And that's hard.
Yep.
And that's why, you know, this context of America or just our kind of collective practices towards self-reliance. I mean, it has a logic to it. It's like, yeah. Oh, I don't want to feel these hard things.
Totally.
I don't want to do that. And we miss.
You don't have to rely on anybody else. Yes. Then right. You don't, nobody's ever going to say no to you because you're not asking.
That's right.
And that's just such a trap. It's such a trap, right? Because it's not about not ever hearing no.
Yeah,
it's exactly. About like, right? Like, it's not about that. It's not about avoiding no. And in some ways, I feel like it's also about like, you got to have like a bunch of relationships. So you're not just asking mm-hmm. one person for the things that you need, right? And that we're able to discern between the things that we need to give to ourselves and the things that we actually really like want and deserve to have from other people, but that those things shouldn't come from one relationship. And I think this goes to, you know, kind of one of the many underlying problems with the insular nuclear family and the way that we're taught to think about, you know, our partners or spouses. And that is like this really gross fairy tale that you're going to find, you know, a person. And they're going to be, you know, they're going to be the person who you fall in love with and that you are like sexually attracted to and that you're going to run a household with and manage finances with. And if you're going to have kids, you're going to raise children, like all, they're going to be your travel buddy. They're your best friend, like all these things that we're told we're meant to not just get from one person, but provide for one person. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that is a setup. Like that is mm-hmm. such a setup because nobody can do that. So I feel like part of it is like one of the things that I noticed that I was already practicing, but that I feel like I made more explicit is that, you know, in my marriage, I try to be clear with myself about what are the things that I'm trying to get from in my relationship with my husband and what are the things that I'm getting in other relationships. And it's not about diminishing the importance of my marriage, but it really is about like elevating the importance of all these other relationships.
We have all these ceremonies, or we have the wedding ceremony that could really be about, and maybe was at some point or is in some places, about a community declaring their commitment even to a marriage, to a couple of people, that they're committing also to be engaged, to support, to be in relationship with us. I got married 6 years ago and we really tried to make our ceremony about that. It's mm-hmm. like, how our friendship strengthened here? How yes. do we get to know each other's people? How do our friends commit to us? But so much of that gets lost with the pressure of, oh, you're married. Now you two have everything for each other.
Yep.
The end.
Totally.
And it's just not sustainable.
And we don't, I feel like there's a way in which, I would say, especially when people, if couples that have children, there's a way in which we have these weird boundaries that make it hard for people to like push inside of the little like bubble that people create. Like it requires so much intention because you're working against the kind of norm of our culture. And I feel like that's part of what I have to do is like be vigilant to make sure that, you know, the people who need to be in on the inside of like my marriage and in the inside of my kids' lives too, I have to continually just like tend to those relationships because I think there is a hesitancy that people have to like step inside of them. And I will say like, let me be clear. I'm straight. I feel like straight folks are particularly susceptible to that way of being in family. The most powerful kind of examples and lessons that I've gotten about how to do family in a different way, and also like specifically raising children, is from queer people. That's just true.
Yeah, you know, in your book, you know, you mentioned in your book, you're like, I'm straight, I'm married to a man. And I was like, there are so many queer stories in this book. Like, totally. There are a few books where I've experienced this many stories of queer family. And it was so helpful for me because I'm queer to be affirmed in that way, but also to be getting some ideas. I'm like, okay, that's good. That'll work. But I was just so appreciative of how queer your book was.
I'm was so, so glad because part of this was about like my own process and journey. And as somebody who does narrative and culture change work, I also am thinking about, here's this old frame that we have about what family looks like, right? And what friendships are supposed to mean and what community is. I know what I think that my vision of like our new frame is, like, how do I populate that? And I was like, and also can I do this thing that's countering, right, all of these assumptions and stereotypes about Black families, about queer families, about poor families, where our families are talked about as broken or deviant or whatever. I'm like, no, those are the places where I feel like I've learned the most about how to step into like these truths about who we are as human beings, but also like this like liberatory process of like being wholly myself, you know? And I feel like I'm very clear that and this is where I feel like, you know, I'm like, oh, this is what it means when we talk about, you know, my liberation as a Black person, right, is tied up in the liberation of like trans people or queer people. I'm super aware of the ways in which people who are having to like push against our cultural and societal boundaries to just be themselves are also creating more room for me. And that's like, right. I may for the rest of my life identify as a woman, but what that means for me now is so different from what it was for me, you know, 20 years ago when I really didn't know my understanding and my like awareness of people in my like life who were either gender nonconforming or trans was very different. I sit inside of being a woman in a very different way and in a way that feels more authentic and right because other folks are like, that's not what I'm doing. Like, that's not how I'm thinking about my own identity or my own gender. You know, so there's like, there was definitely some like strategy in there, but like the truth is that Black queer folks, like that's where I feel like everything that I need to know about being a free Black person, like that's where those answers are for me. That's just true. So
I'll take it.
Good.
I also feel like there's such a lesson in there about community not necessarily being about sameness, that you can be learning from each other, and community is not about a kind of safe or safe and kind of the not really safe, but like a safe sameness, that there's the distance between us where we get to like learn from each other and the way that we are doing life or doing family. that I hear in that.
Yeah, I haven't thought about that really. But and ultimately, like, you know, there's the version of talking about kind of humanity as like us being part of, like, you know, the big we, that is a denial of the ways we're different, right? It's the, like, I'm colorblind kind of version. And then there's a version of it that is a, like, deep celebration and embracing of the ways in which we are different, and a willingness and commitment to work through all of the practiced and internalized oppression. And you get to the, like, big we that way, but it's, like, not the fucked up version that like is gaslighting these experiences of oppression. But part of what, you know, I'm like, oh, like, it really is that me and the, like, white guy across the street and, like, the tree in my yard, right? Like, we are all each other's relations. Ultimately, like, what feels good for me is, and I think this is, you know, and I am like, constitutionally a very, like, wholehearted person and genuinely love people and people's stories, and I want to be in relationship with people. And I think that the best version of me is when I meet someone or I'm around people, I am looking for, like, what I can love about them. And that don't mean that, like, I don't get pissed at people or, like, decide I don't want to be friends with somebody, but I feel like that orientation feels important to me, just to, like, maintain my integrity. And ultimately what I do think is my own kind of continual practice of trying to be a free Black person. I actually want to find something to love in everybody. And it's not, you know, it's not, like, it's not unconditional. It's not without discernment, but it is a way of, like, seeing through all of the ultimately, like, false made up barriers that exist between us and other people to see toward some kind of common humanity.
I'm going to ask this question by way of kind of a story, which is that my partner and I moved to basically outside of Durham in the country in December. And we had a couple months of nesting and, you know, doing your thing when you move into a new home, getting it ready. And we thought, okay, we're going to nest for a couple months and then we're going to really actively build community. And Rona hit. And so we've basically been in extended nesting. And, you know, we have friends out here, but we haven't been able to do the kind of community building we envisioned. But, you know, when we first moved here, this is going to sound dorky, but we baked cookies and went around to all the neighbors and introduced ourselves.
Fantastic.
We did that in part because, you know, we want to know people and also because we are a queer couple living in the country. So we were like, we want you to lay your eyes on us so you know who we are. You get to feel us in person. We're real. And so these are the folks around us in this community have been who we've been riding this whole COVID situation out with. And it wasn't initially our intention, but, you know, we eat the eggs that my neighbor across the street, his chickens lay. We make pickles for our neighbors with the adjacent property to us. We share garden equipment. We get our horse manure from the family two plots down. And I feel this sense of community that I haven't felt in a long time. Like, we're actually really watching out for each other. We're actually sharing our abundance with one another. And I don't know that I would have been in that deep of practice with the folks immediately around me if not for this context. And, you know, I just have a lot of reflection there, but I have a question for you, is, like, how has this moment changed your practice of community, or what are you learning about your practice of community from the pressures that we're currently experiencing?
I love that story so much. And in part because of, like, I think you're right, right? Like, if this hadn't happened, would your neighbors be the first people who you'd try to be building community with? Yeah. I love that story. So for me, I think it has largely been this kind of tapping into the generosity of giving and the generosity of receiving. One of the things that's been really powerful is kind of how it created more thread in the fabric of the weave that I have with this circle of Black women who I've been in community with, formal community with, for 4 years. We started this circle 4 years ago and have met every month in person since then. And when sheltering in place started, we started meeting virtually twice a month because we all really needed it.
Yeah.
So that part happened. But then there was also this, like, you know, in March and April, there was this flurry of us trading vegetable starts and seeds because we were trying to make sure all of us got our gardens in. And some of us, you know, one of the women in the group is like expert, like master gardener. And some of us have never gardened before. So we just did all of this. There was this, like, you know, I was leaving things on my front steps for people to come and pick up. And after it kind of settled down, I was like, oh, like, we just made sure that all of us have, like, food.
Yes.
Even though, like, you know, I'm not necessarily going to be I'm not bringing my harvest to somebody. I'm making sure that they have what they need to have a harvest of their own. You know, there've been more conversations, I think, because all of, like, our nerves are fried and our emotions are so much closer to the surface. I think that a lot of the conversations that I've been having with people have been more revealing and more, like, emotionally honest than they may have been otherwise. And that feels like a little bit of a gift. I've been holding a lot of space for other folks. I've had to recalibrate kind of, like, energetically my boundaries, because it very much feels like the thing that I'm drawn to doing in this moment. It feels restorative in many ways. I've been receiving a lot of people's stuff, and I have not figured this out yet, but I'm having to get better at figuring out where to put it down. Where to, like, you know, if I'm like a conduit for it, like, how do I make sure that, like, the out is open? And that has not really been something that I'm doing with other people. It's really been what I'm doing with, like, the earth. My therapist gave me this amazing practice. Because I talked to her about this. I was like, where do I put all this stuff? And she said to me that, you know, the earth can hold every single ounce of human suffering and pain. Exactly. And anguish and hardship, and, like, not even break a sweat. She was like, go lay down on the ground. She had me put my right ear to the earth and just, like, let everything that I'm holding just, like, pour out of me, and just stay like that until it's done. And then she said, and then turn your left ear to the earth and listen for the message that she has for you. That's the other thing I think that has actually changed a lot in this time, is that my community has expanded to, like, more definitively include bees, birds, trees, plants, soil, worms. I can't go and hug my best friend, but I can totally go hug this plum tree in my yard. And we don't have to worry. Like, we have to physically distance from humans, not from all of our relations.
That's right.
And that's felt just super important. I feel like, especially for folks who are sheltering in place by themselves, like, to feel those relationships more deeply so that we don't feel so isolated. That's right. Feels important. So I've been doing a lot of that. And to be clear, like, I'm sheltering in place with 3 other people. I'm not by myself at all.
Right.
But there's a kind of support that I think that humans can get from non-human living things, you know, including things like rocks and dirt. That feels really important in this moment.
That's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. Everything you're saying about including, almost expanding our care and relationship to include those entities that are not human is so critical. I know for me, you know, our compost bin, our compost pile is such a reminder to let myself be more of a process and less of a machine. And to let things move through me that way. So I'm facilitating conflicts or things like that, or just working with people like you're saying that are just moving through a lot or holding space. And I go to my compost bin and to get the reminder that I can be a process. I can be a place where things can move through.
I love that.
And that's actually a part. That's a part of our lineage. That's a part of us. So yes, so much to tapping into that wisdom and resource. Mia, thank you so, so much for taking the time to be in this conversation, to be in community, really. It really feels like, you know, we are kind of orbiting in different places in community, but I feel like this conversation, we're kind of reaching across that, and I really feel, honored just to be in more conversation with you and to be building with you. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
And thank you, Prentice, for listening to the wise part of you that said that you needed to create this space for you to like share more of what you know and your wisdom and to be in conversation with the people who you think have some stuff we all need to hear in this moment. I'm so grateful.
Wow. Thank you, Mia. Thanks so much. Finding Our Way is co-produced and edited by Eddie Hemphill. Co-production and visual design by Devin Delaney. Please make sure to rate, subscribe, and review wherever it is you listen to this podcast. You can also follow us on Instagram at Finding Our Way Podcast or email us with questions, suggestions, or feedback at findingourwaypod@gmail.com. You can also help sustain the podcast by becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. You can find us on Patreon at Finding Our Way Podcast. Thank you for listening to Finding Our Way.